All right. Good to see you all today. A good, healthy showing on this day. Anybody going to watch a football game later today? A lot of you are. Well, I'm excited about the game. I'm more excited that the living God has spoken to us and wants to speak into our lives and change them. And so I'd invite you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We're going to pick up where Steve left off last week. But before we get into that passage, I want to share a story with you. It's a story about a young guy named Robert Robinson. He lived in the mid-1700s in England, and when he was very young, his father died, and he really struggled early in life, and he had to be a breadwinner for his mom and for himself. And as often happens with people who are forced to grow up much earlier than they should, he fell in with a pretty rough crowd. And he became a rowdy kind of hooligan from his as a young boy, a young adolescent, and then into his young adulthood, lived a rowdy, immoral life. And by the time he was about 20 years old, he was still living this profligate life. And but he heard there was a celebrity coming to town that he really wanted to go see in person. And the celebrity's name was George Whitefield. Now, for those of you who don't know the name, he was kind of the Billy Graham of his era. He would get this massive crowds wherever he went to speak. But Robert Robinson was, he didn't want to go alone to see this guy. And he was too embarrassed to tell his friends that he wanted to go see this preacher. And so he invited his friends to go heckle the preacher with him. So he turns up to this live preaching event, and George Whitefield starts preaching that day on his text was Matthew chapter 3, verse 7, where John the Baptist was standing before crowds and addressed them and said, "You brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the coming wrath?" And here was Robert Robinson, who showed up kind of as a skeptic, unwilling, uncertain what was going on, and he was pierced to the heart. He was convicted of his sin, and he turned to God. He found peace with God through submitting his life to Christ and faith in him, and God gave him a new heart. And within a couple years, he had become a pastor. And at about 22, 23 years old, as this young pastor, he wrote a song out, and we're still singing the song today. You might recognize it. "Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing call for songs of loudest praise." He wrote that to celebrate his newfound faith. But I think the reason that that song resonates with so many of us is the way it ends. The part of the last stanza that really grips me anyway is when he says, "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart. Take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above." Can any of you resonate with those lines, "prone to wander"? Well, as it turns out, there's a story about the end of his life. I did some digging this week. I couldn't verify if it was true or false, but if it's true, this widely told story is a pretty sad one. It's about many years later, at the end of Robert Robinson's life, he was a passenger in a stagecoach, and he was sharing the stagecoach with a stranger, a woman, who, to pass the time on their ride, began singing a song. You know what she sang? Probably guess it. "Come thou fount of every blessing." And when she got to the end, she asked her traveling partner, "What do you think of that song?" And he was supposed to have said, "Madame, I am the unhappy man who wrote that hymn many years ago. And I would give 1,000 worlds if I could feel now as if I had then." It seems like he had wandered. He had left the God he loves. He loved. And far from being a story that is unusual, unfortunately, there are many who started the Christian life well, but they didn't finish well. They wandered. They left God. And it's that sad fact that led Paul to write what he did today that we're going to look at in Romans 9, or 1 Corinthians rather, 9 and 10. He wants to ensure that these people who started off so well, who he led to Christ, don't fall away from God's grace. So before we jump in and read what we're going to today, let me just recap kind of where this falls in the letter. It's really important you know. 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, Paul is dealing with the same issue throughout. He wants to warn these people about their practice of going and eating in pagan temples and celebrating what would have been called idol feasts there. And now we know that Paul was carrying a correspondence with those Corinthians through letters. And it seems that the first letter that Paul sent them, he had told them, do not do this. This is going to be destructive to your faith. Don't go to these pagan temples. But they had sent back a letter bristling at this admonishment. And their reasoning probably went something like this. They probably said, Paul, we all have knowledge. And we know that these idols are really nothing. There's only one true God. So when we go to these temples, we're just going to them as restaurants. Now, you have to know that these Gentile believers, they would have been going to these temples to eat all their lives. It would have been very natural to them because these pagan temples were not only worship centers, they were also, well, they're like the meat department at Vaughn's, and they were like In-N-Out Burger, all wrapped into one. It's where people would have gone to buy meat for the butcher or to go celebrate an evening out. So this was natural to them. And they probably were saying, hey, we're not in it for the religious part. And furthermore, we also know about food, that our relationship with God isn't based on what we eat or don't eat, right? We agree with that. So we have the right to eat whatever we want. Now, it also seems that they had said to Paul something like, who are you anyway to tell us one way or the other what we can or can't eat? And this is why in chapter 8 that we looked at a couple weeks ago, as Benji showed us, Paul took them to task and he said, Christian ethics, let's see if you can finish this, is not based on rights or knowledge, but on, I heard it somewhere over there, but on love. The ethic for Christians is not based on knowledge or rights, it's based on love. And then last week, Steve preached on Romans chapter, why do I keep saying Romans? We're in 1 Corinthians. Hope you're there. I am. He defended his apostolic authority, saying, hey, I'm not in this to make myself look good or for my own rights or privileges. I'm in it for the gospel. I'm in it for Jesus and to get the word out about him. So in today's passage, he's continuing to make this case that their behavior doesn't fit with their newfound faith and their allegiance to Christ. And he's warning them about a path that could lead to disaster, okay? So are we there together? So let's stand, if you're able, and we're going to honor God's word by standing and reading 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting in verse 24, where Steve left off last week. So listen to the word of God. Paul says this. He says, do not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and I keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. And we must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble, as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed, lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God indeed. Have a seat. Keep your Bibles open. So we're just going to go through this kind of step by step here. The first section there at the end of chapter 9, Paul gives this exhortation in the form of an athletic metaphor that would have been very familiar to the Corinthians. If you remember from your study guide a couple weeks ago, it reminded us that Corinth was the home of the biannual Isthmian Games that took place every other year. These competitions were second only in popularity to the Olympics, and thousands of people would come from all over the empire to watch these games and to compete in these games. Gordon Fee, one of the commentators in 1 Corinthians, he actually suggests that Paul would have been in Corinth during the Isthmian Games of AD 51. It would have provided a great opportunity for him not only to sell the tents that he made to the tourists who were coming in town looking for a place to stay, but also a chance to preach the gospel to these thousands of folks who have come to watch the games. At any point, the illustration, the crux of the illustration comes right at the beginning, where Paul says, "Don't you know, in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize. So here's the point, so run that you may obtain it. Run to win. Keep the end in mind," he wants them to remember. Eyes on the prize, finish well. That's his point of all this. Now, to make the point, he fleshes it out. In verse 25, he says, "Every athlete exercises self-control." The verb exercises in Greek comes from the form agonizomai. You can hear our word agony in there, right? And his point is, to be a competitive athlete, you have to be willing to suffer, to agonize a little bit, to discipline and control your body and to bring it and shape it into something that can win. So in like manner, discipline yourself that way as a Christian. He says that they do it for an imperishable, but we a they do it for a perishable wreath. Now, at the Isthmian Games, the winners were crowned, get this, with a crown of celery. That seems like kind of an odd triumph to get, like, ta-da! And obviously, the celery would wilt after not too long. Paul says, we do it for an imperishable prize. Peter says, our inheritance is one that can never perish, spoil, or fade. It's kept in heaven for us. It's a much greater prize than a crown of celery. Aren't you glad for that? I love how Leon Morris puts it in his commentary. He says, "The strenuous self-denial of the athlete as he sought a fleeting reward is a rebuke to half-hearted, flabby Christian service." Paul's word here is, let's go, focus, dedication, people. There's a great prize to be won. But if you aren't careful, you can't achieve it. Look at verse 26 again. He says, "I don't run aimlessly." Now just picture a track meet. If you go to a track meet, all the runners line up and it's like, "On your marks, get set," and imagine if all the runners run down the track except for one person who starts running around aimlessly in the middle of the infield. Like, I don't care how fast that person is, they are not winning that race, right? And it's the same thing for a boxer who beats the air. You can imagine two guys, one's just kind of shadow boxing. If he doesn't realize that the point of boxing is to put that guy on his back, then he's in trouble. He is not going to win the prize. In the same way, Paul says, keep your eyes focused. Keep eyes on the prize. And then he uses himself as an example. He says, "I discipline my body and I keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." That is not finish well, not get the prize. And it's this word at the end, disqualified, that leads Paul to search for an example that he can use as a cautionary tale, kind of like a Robert Robinson tale. Now, anybody can become a cautionary tale. It's sad, but it's true. I found myself living out a cautionary tale just a couple weeks ago. Lara came to me and said, she was on the side of our house and she smelt gas. And she said, well, you know, can you take care of that? And I knew exactly what had happened. See, we have a gas line that runs out of the side of our house. And it's got a little on-off valve, and then it goes into our barbecue, our grill. And then from there, the line goes out to our back patio where we have a gas fire pit. And we had been sitting at the gas fire pit earlier that day, and we had turned that off, but evidently, you know, we had forgotten to shut off the other valve, and so it was probably coming through to our barbecue why she smelled the gas. So I'm a good husband. I said, I'll take care of this. And then she said, I wish she hadn't said this, she said, be careful that there doesn't spark up something that could be bad. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I thought, you know, even if there was a little spark, it would just kind of contain itself within the barbecue because there was a cover on the barbecue. So she said, just be careful. Now, when you start telling somebody like, be careful, be careful, my reaction is like, I'm going to show you what's going on. So you can see what's coming. I said, I'm going to show you. So I went inside and I got the little fire starter. And I know. So I had shut off the gas valve. I did that right, okay? And then I pulled up the cover to the barbecue, and sure enough, there was a little knob on it that I'd left slightly on. So I turned that off, and the whole time she's saying, don't do this. This is a bad idea. I said, just watch. It's just going to fill up the barbecue with fire, and it's going to be kind of cool. And so I stick the lighter, I kind of open it up, and I start clicking. And at this point, she's running inside the house. She says, don't do this. This is bad. And right about when she gets inside, it finally clicked on. And this massive fireball just blew at me, knocked me into the back fence, and all the hair on my arm was completely singed off and burned. I had, you know, singed hair up here. It was just totally dumb. And I realized at that moment how close I had come to becoming a Darwin Award winner, you know, one of those people who take their genes out of the gene pool because they're so stupid. Anyway. Some of you are thinking right now, why should I listen to another thing that this guy says after he just shared how dumb he is? And to be honest, I don't have a good answer to that question. Other than we're going to get back to the Word of God here. So my point in all this, Paul is looking for a tale like that, a cautionary tale to say, don't do that. And he finds the perfect example in the people of Israel. And so that's what he's going to unpack in the coming verses. So let's look at it together. He sets up the story in such a way that the Corinthians can identify with Israel. He calls them our fathers. They're the ones who have gone before us in the faith. And then he lists four privileges that the Israelites had enjoyed. Look at it. He says in verse 1, they were all under the cloud and they all passed through the sea. Verse 3, they all ate spiritual food. That's a reference to the manna that God gave them supernaturally to eat in the wilderness. And verse 4, they all drank spiritual drink. This is a reference to them, God giving water miraculously out of the rock to satisfy their thirst in the desert. Now, these four miraculous experiences they had, Paul is choosing for a very specific purpose. Remember, he's trying to encourage them not to go to these idolatrous feasts. Now, watch what he does. He says that being under the cloud and going through the Red Sea was kind of a baptism of sorts. Who else has been baptized? Well, the Corinthians have all been baptized too. And then he says they all drank spiritual food and spiritual drink. Well, who else experiences weekly a special divine meal? The Corinthians do, as we do today. We're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. We're going to eat and drink a spiritual meal. And so he's, again, getting them to identify with the Israelites. And then he lowers the boom in verse 5. He says, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Literally, that means their bodies were strewn throughout the desert. And then in verse 6, He says, now these took place as examples for us, a cautionary tale that we might not desire evil as they did. What Paul is saying is, he's saying these people had remarkable experiences with God, but that's no substitute for an ongoing relationship with God. Don't think that you're beyond temptation, prone to wander. Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God we love. That's the experience of Israel. And Paul's saying, don't let that happen to you. Now, in verses 7 to 11, he's already lined up four privileges. Now he's going to lay out four ways that Israel proved faithless. Look at it with me. Verse 7, he says, don't be idolaters as some of them were. And then he quotes from Exodus chapter 32, which is where the story of the golden calf is. Do you remember that story? Where Moses goes up on the mountain, and after a while, the people, he's up there for a long time, and the people are discouraged. And so they give all this gold to Aaron, and they say, do something with this. And he makes for them an idol of a golden calf. Now, Paul could have quoted from any part of that story, but he chooses to quote this bit, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. He's taking this idolatrous moment and joining it with their eating and drinking. Why? Well, again, he's trying to persuade these people not to do the same thing, to join an idol feast. Secondly, he said, we must not be sexually immoral as they were in verse 8. Now, this is a reference to Numbers chapter 25, where the people, again, they're engaging with the idolatrous practices of the Moabites, and at the same time, they're engaging in sexual immorality with them. And this would have been a regular occurrence at the pagan temples in Corinth. And we know that the Corinthians struggled with this. Paul's already written to them in chapter 6 about their sexual immorality. Thirdly, verse 9. He says, we must not put Christ to the test as they did. And Paul is basically insinuating that by insisting on their right to keep eating these idol feasts, they are doing exactly that. They're putting the Lord to the test. And lastly, in verse 10, he says, nor should we grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, who did Israel grumble against? You remember? They grumbled against God, but they were also grumbling constantly against God's appointed leader, against Moses. And basically, Paul is subtly comparing the Corinthians, who are grumbling against him, to what the Israelites did in the desert, grumbling against their leader, Moses. So again, in verse 11, he says, this is a cautionary tale for you. These things happened to them as an example. They were written down for our instruction on whom the end of the ages has come. In other words, all the things that happened in the past are pointing forward to Christ and those who will follow Christ. So the stakes have never been higher, Paul wants them to know. This is important stuff. This is not just ancient history. This is for our instruction. Now, friends, I want to let you know, these same four things that Paul warns them against are huge temptations for us today. Now, we may not make idols out of stone or wood, clay, but idolatry happens anytime we seek significance or control or comfort or security in another person or thing rather than in the living God. And this is a constant struggle for the people of God. This idolatry. Not only that, he warns them and he warns us against sexual immorality. And friends, we just got to acknowledge we live in an age where sexual mores are in our culture are far different from the standards that God sets up for us in the scriptures. That is purity outside of marriage. How about testing the Lord? Do we ever do that? Testing the Lord comes anytime where we tend to rationalize our behavior or push the boundaries on what is acceptable to God. And finally, grumbling. Man, this has been a tough season we've lived through, but the difficulties of life did not give us an excuse to grumble rather than practice an attitude of gratitude. So this is all very real stuff for us today. And Paul, in laying out this story, I hope you've heard it, he's been rather dramatic. He says they were overthrown, verse 5. They fell, verse 8. They were destroyed, verse 9. The summary comes in verse 12. Look at it. He says, therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. This is Paul's way of flashing the lights, of waving the flags, of posting big warning signs out and saying, don't do it. I can just hear Lara's voice and Paul's words here. Don't do it. Don't be dumb. Don't go there. Let me say this before we finish up. If you don't feel like you are vulnerable to temptation, watch out. That is a very dangerous place to be. The most godly people are those humble enough to realize how prone to wander we are, how prone to leave God we are apart from God's grace. But I realize what we've been through so far, this is pretty hard stuff to listen to and to wade through. But the last verse brings us a remarkable hope and an amazing promise. And it's this. Listen, you don't have to be a cautionary tale. You don't have to be that. He says in verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. In other words, what you are going through, the testing, the trials, the difficulties, the struggles that you go through, they're par for the course. They're normal for human beings. Now, Satan would love nothing more than to bury you in a mountain of guilt and shame and to make you feel like you are the worst sinner there ever was. And that if anyone else here knew what went through your mind and your heart, well, you would be ostracized. You'd be put out of here in no time. I just want to say to you, if you feel like this morning that you are a spiritual weakling, if you feel constantly vulnerable to sin, if you feel embarrassed that you're still wrestling with the same temptations you thought you would be done with a long time ago, if that's you, welcome to Santa Barbara Community Church. You're among good company here. We need each other, and we stand in solidarity with one another, and that's why you'll hear so much around here about getting into a small group where we can share life, where we can be honest with one another and say, you know what, we deal with the same kind of things, not the same circumstances or situations, but the root behind our struggles are the same. Now, after this, Paul gives just an amazing word of hope that we should all cling to. He says, God is faithful. God is faithful. Our God is not a vindictive God who's just waiting for a chance to watch you screw up so he can come down with a hammer. That's not the picture of the God of the Bible. Rather, we get a picture of a faithful God. Listen, your hope in your struggles is not your own willpower. I hope you figure that out by now. Your hope and my hope is in God and his faithfulness, and that he will walk through our struggles and trials with us. Now, look at the promise he gives right after that. He says, God is faithful, and here's a promise. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. That's such a beautiful promise for sinners like me. What he's saying here is he won't let you be tested beyond your breaking point. He won't let it happen. This is, again, the scriptures teach throughout that God is sovereign. And he could do whatever he wants, but he will not let you be tempted beyond what you can endure. The truth is that everything that comes into your life, even the hard things, whether that is called cancer or whether that's a broken relationship that's causing you to just grieve and be so thoroughly anxious, anguished, whether that's some financial hardship you have or anything else, God will not let that trial overwhelm you to the point that you can't endure it without his help. You need to know that today. And he tags on to that promise another beautiful phrase. He says, but with the temptation, he will always provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. And you need to understand what that means. It does not mean that if you pray hard enough when you're tempted, God will just remove the temptation from your life, or that he'll just remove that test from your life. Look at it again. He says he will provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Not that you won't have to endure it, but that you can endure it. That we can gear up like an athlete and steel ourselves for what's ahead and pray for God's grace to make it through. And he said, I'll give you that way of escape every time. Again, not to get around the temptation or the testing, but to make a way through it. Grace comes to us so that we don't have to yield to sin and doubt, but that we can stand firm. What's the way of escape? The way of escape is to look to Jesus. Jesus is our way of escape. And we're going to come to the Lord's Supper in just a second. And I want to give you a time to be quiet in just a moment. But listen here. When Paul says that there's no temptation but that which is common to man, he's not only saying common to everyone here. He's saying no temptation that you go through is not common to the man, Jesus Christ. Our testings were known by him. They've been experienced by him who is our representative, our high priest. Hebrews puts it like this, for we do not have a representative. We don't have a high priest who's unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has himself been tested. He's been tempted in every way, just as we are. The only difference is he never wandered from God. He never left God. He never sinned. And so the invitation is, let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. So I want to invite you, before we come to the Lord's Supper, let's just take a moment of quiet. It's a great time to admit to God how weak you are, how prone to wander you know you would be without his sustaining grace. And thank God that he has gone before us. He's the author and perfecter of our faith who endured much for our sake that we might live. So let's just be quiet before God, confess our sins and our need for